This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents White Trash Zombie Unchained. Written by Diana Rowland. Performed by Allison Mecklemore.
Chapter 1. 10 more measly miles. My index fingers drummed a happy beat on the steering wheel. I hadn't been home in 3 weeks. Not since Mardi Gras, when a four-wheeler chase through the woods ended with me literally falling apart. Flying limbs, rotting chunks, not pretty. Up ahead, a squirrel darted onto the road, then thought better of it and dashed back to the pines. My heart pounded stupidly hard, and I eased my death grip on the wheel. In theory, I was regrown, rehabbed, and ready to take on the world. In reality, this was my first time in the driver's seat since the accident, and I was still getting used to my new parts. Thankfully, there was almost no traffic along this part of Highway 51, the rural two-lane road between the zombie research lab and my house. Even with my extra cautious driving, I was making good time. I dug through the baggie on my lap for a desiccated brain chip, a get-well gift from my friend Naomi. Perfectly freeze-dried and dusted with Cajun spices, it was the certified junk food of the zombie gods. My phone buzzed the instant I stuffed the chip in my mouth, with the caller ID showing ZB. I rolled my eyes, unsurprised at the call. A little over a year ago, I'd been forced to turn badass operative Philip Reinhardt into a zombie, which I figured made him my zombie baby. In return, Philip had become a teensy bit protective of me. If I didn't answer, he'd no doubt come looking for his zombie mama. I stuck in an earbud and hit the answer button. "Hey, ZB," I chirped. "How's it going?"
"You snuck out of the lab."
"I didn't. You just happened to be in the bathroom when I left."
"Right."
Lucky for me, he sounded more amused than pissed.
"Dr. Nikus recommended you stay another day."
"Yep, recommended, not ordered. It's cool. I don't have to go back to work until tomorrow, so it'll be fine. I'm just gonna hang out with my dad."
"I could have driven you home. I'm not sure your reflexes are up to."
"Dr. Nikus wouldn't have let me go if he was worried. He'd actually said I wasn't quite back to my normal self, but was likely no worse off than most drivers out there. That was good enough for me." "You did your zombie baby duty and wheeled me around to my classes last week. You're off the hook." He laughed.
"I give up. Don't come crying to me when you have a fender bender."
"You'll be the first one I blame." I caught sight of a car in my rearview mirror. It was a good half mile behind, but closing way too fast. "Let me call you later. Gotta focus." My speedometer read 62 miles per hour, which meant this asswipe was doing at least 90. My contrary side dared me to slow down and straddle the center line, but the morgue tech in me had seen enough vehicular fatalities to put an end to that fantasy. With one eye on the rearview mirror, I edged close to the side of the road and slowed to a respectable 50. Despite my bluster to Philip, I didn't trust my reflexes 100% yet, and I trusted the speeder's level of stupid even less, especially considering the flash of blue lights in the distance behind him. The speeding car swerved into the other lane even as I eased my right wheels onto the narrow band of gravel between road and ditch. I stopped and waited. 3, 2, 1, whoom! My car rocked in the wake of the speeding silver Camry. I caught the barest glimpse of the driver as the car blew past. Male. Maybe. I stayed put and kept watch behind me, not about to move until the pursuit passed. An unmarked midnight blue Dodge Charger flew by, though nowhere near as fast as Mr. McSpeedy. The driver had dark hair and a surly expression. Detective Mike Abadie, not my favorite person, but a good cop. It looked like he was either backing off from chasing the Camry since high-speed pursuits risked civilians, or he was herding the guy into a roadblock. Curiosity clamoring, I snagged the last brain chip from the baggie and pulled onto the highway. If it was indeed a roadblock, I'd find out soon enough. 3 miles later, I rounded a curve and slowed at a sea of flashing red and blue lights ahead. The two sheriff's office cruisers were parked along the right shoulder, while Abadie's Charger and an unmarked dark green Chevy Impala blocked my lane. On the other side of the highway, the Camry rested with its nose in the ditch. The driver lay face down on the asphalt as a tall black woman in plain clothes handcuffed him. Beside her, Abadie holstered his weapon. Closer to me, a stick-thin deputy with scraggly blonde hair packed away a set of spike strips. Beckett Connor. We'd been out on at least a dozen scenes together over the past year. Decent guy. Bad haircut. The second deputy motioned for me to stop. Fit, muscled, hair shorn and a crisp high and tight. He'd been hired only a few months ago. And though we'd chatted on several scenes, I couldn't remember his name for the life of me. I rolled down my window, trying not to be too obvious as I peered at his name tag. Hey! You Blagojevic? How the hell was that pronounced? You, I said brightly. What's going on? Whoa! My train of thought derailed as my gaze lifted to his face. That's an impressive sunburn. Hey, Angel. He managed a weak smile from his tomato-colored face. Yeah. Connor and I spent 4 hours on the water yesterday. And you've never heard of sunscreen? Connor barked out a laugh, his face and arms darn near as red as his partner's. Our boy here brought the sunscreen, except turns out it was plain old lotion. But hey, my skin's as soft as a baby's bottom. Uh-huh. If my baby's bottom looked like that, I'd take it back to the hospital. Wouldn't blame you, Connor replied with a wink, then turned away to load the spike strip case into the trunk of his cruiser. So, anything exciting going on here? I asked you, Blagojevic, lifting my chin toward the man being handcuffed. He shrugged. Just another day at the office. You know how it is. Well, that was completely unhelpful. But before I could ask a more probing question, Connor hollered that the road was clear. You can go on through now, Blaggy said. But take it easy till you're past the vehicles. I rolled up my window, then took full advantage of my slow speed to shamelessly gawk at the spectacle. The Camry's tires were thoroughly shredded, and the airbag lay like a deflated jellyfish over the steering wheel. Abadie and the plainclothes woman had pulled the handcuffed guy to his feet, allowing me a good view of him. His nose was bloody, and he had on a tricolor dark gray t-shirt. Definitely didn't look like a typical car thief. Maybe he was an embezzler on the run? Or a serial killer? Whatever his crime, he looked pissed. The woman glanced my way, and all thoughts of the bad guy's identity fled. Short-cropped graying hair and a distinctive scar that started beneath one ear and ran across her throat. FBI Special Agent Sorsha Aberdeen. Her eyes narrowed in recognition. Crap. I yanked my gaze away and continued past the vehicle. I had plenty of questions, but no way in hell I was going to stop and ask them. Not while an FBI agent who I suspected knew zombies were real was around. I'd only met her once, right before Mardi Gras, during her investigation of a short film that included footage of real zombies. I'd pretended the zombie rod on my cheek was part of a costume, but that woman was smart and suspicious, and my gut told me she wasn't fooled by my fib. As soon as I was clear, I stepped on the gas and got my ass out of there. My paranoid side expected the FBI agent to come chasing after me. But my rearview mirror remained free of flashing lights and official vehicles. I eventually turned onto the road that led to my house, then slowed behind a FedEx truck, most likely destined for old Mrs. Grady, who lived across from us. Ever since her husband passed away last year, she'd taken to ordering nonstop from the shopping websites and got deliveries damn near every day. Sure enough, the truck stopped a few feet behind my driveway. The driver exited the truck carrying an Amazon box about the size of a sofa pillow. I hopped out to check the mail and gave him a wave. "Hiya, Chester. Another one for Mrs. Grady, I see."
"Nope. This one's for you, Angel. Good thing you're here. Can't release it without your sig."
"For me, huh? Maybe my dad had ordered a welcome home gift for me? Or a new toilet seat? Knowing my dad, it could go either way." I tossed today's bills and junk mail onto the passenger seat, then exchanged my signature for the package. Definitely big enough for a toilet seat, but a bit too heavy. While Chester delivered an unwieldy pile of 4 packages to the neighbor, I set the box on top of the mail and drove on up to the house. A warm, fuzzy feeling wrapped around me as I climbed out of the car. Home. An almost new, 2-bedroom prefabricated house with sky blue siding and a tidy porch. Real gravel for a driveway, too, instead of the carpet of crushed beer cans it once had. The place wasn't much, but it was ours. Replacing the rickety excuse for a house that got washed away in the flood last year. But even if it had still been the same old piece of crap house, I'd have been just as thrilled. Box and mail in hand, I trotted up the steps and pushed the front door open. "Hey, Dad, I'm home." "Surprise!" my dad hollered and popped up from behind the sofa. All on his lonesome, but grinning wide enough for 20 people. I grinned right back and placed the box on the coffee table. "You throwing me a one-man surprise party?"
"Sure," he chortled. "I thought about inviting all of your friends and zombie pals and such, then decided, screw 'em. I wanted it to be just the two of us."
He hurried over and wrapped me in a big, bony hug.
"I'm so damn glad to have you home, Angelkins."
"I'm glad to be home, Dad." Tears stung my eyes as I hugged him. He'd done the best he could to raise me after my mom went to prison, where she killed herself a few years later. Unfortunately, my dad's best had been pretty rough at times. But that was all behind us now. He had sobered up, and we were closer than we'd ever been. He smelled of aqua velva, toothpaste, and cigarette smoke, damn it. He'd told me he was going to quit. I suppressed the urge to grill him about it since it would probably end up with us fighting. Not only would that ruin the moment, but Jimmy Crawford was so stubborn there was a good chance he'd go out and smoke a pack out of spite. He finally released me.
"What you got in the box?"
"No clue. I thought maybe you had ordered something for me."
"I ain't ordered nothing," he said. "Open it up and see what it is."
Armed with a box cutter, I made short work of what had to be half a roll of packing tape, and soon opened the package to reveal a brand spanking new Playbox game console. My dad gave a low whistle.
"That sure looks nice. Who's it from?"
"Hang on." I dug out the packing slip. It didn't show a price, but it had a gift note. "Angel, hope you're feeling better and get a chance to play soon. Your friend, Arnold Stein."
"Huh? Who the hell was Arnold Stein and why would he send..."
A chill raced down my spine. What if someone was trying to plant a bug in my house? Lord knew I'd made plenty of enemies during the past year. Christy Charish, along with everyone involved in the zombie research at Saberton Corporation. Easy enough to find out, though. Tomorrow, I'd borrow the lab's listening device scanner doohickey and do a thorough sweep of the house. Couldn't hurt to be smart and suspicious. My dad peered over my shoulder.
"Who's Arnold Stein?"
"No clue." I didn't want to get my dad worried in case it turned out to be nothing. It has to be a zombie, though, considering this. Arnold Stein knew I wasn't well, and no way would work send me anything. I kept my tone light as I lied through my teeth. But I don't know everyone in the tribe. He could be the tribe guy who takes care of shit like condolence letters and Christmas bonuses, you know? The tribe was a tightly knit organization of zombies and a handful of humans whose objective and purpose was to ensure the welfare and well-being of zombies, by any means necessary at times. That seemed to satisfy him. While he peered at components, I reread the note. What if Arnold Stein, A.S., was actually Andrew Saber? Philip wasn't my only zombie baby. Last fall, Andrew had been shot during a raid on Saberton in New York. I'd turned him, with his permission, to save his life. But becoming a zombie wasn't all sunshine and roses for him. First off, he was a Saber. His mother, Nicole Saber, was the CEO of Saberton Corporation, as well as the driving force behind their heinous abuse of zombies. If she ever found out Andrew was a zombie, he'd end up as a guinea pig in one of Saberton's special research labs. Zombie hell. Unfortunately, he'd come awfully close to exposure right before Mardi Gras when Marla the cadaver dog indicated on him. I suspected one of Andrew's bodyguards had then tattled to Nicole about the dog's behavior. Fortunately, Andrew had anticipated that kind of disaster, and with the help of his primary bodyguard, Thea Braddock, he'd executed his planned exit strategy. Now, as far as anyone could tell, Andrew was visiting possible factory locations overseas. Whether there was any truth to that or not, at least he was out of his mother's clutches. But why the hell would he give me a play box? Sure, I'd saved his life, but to be honest, we didn't really like each other. Andrew was the last person who'd send me a get-well card, much less an expensive gift. With that, my brilliant theory went kablooey. I'd have to do more digging to find the real sender. My dad poked at the console.
Well, don't that beat all? I always wanted to try one of them things.
I'll let you kick my ass in a... I held up the included game cartridge. Swords and Swagger later.
Yep, later, 'cause I got another surprise for you. A cake!
He grabbed my hand and hauled me to the dining room. Set out on the table were two plates and a sheet cake, still in its plastic container with the grocery store sticker on top. Dad bustled around the table to pull the lid off.
I thought about having the lady decorate one with zombies and the like, but then figured she'd wonder why we was doing zombies in the spring instead of Halloween, and I sure didn't want to draw attention to you. So I just went with what they had in the store.
His nose wrinkled at the cake, where a plastic T-Rex and palm tree were surrounded by raggedy green icing roses that were probably supposed to represent prehistoric plants.
They didn't have much selection.
It's awesome, Dad. I hugged him again. You even got them to write welcome home. I held back a snicker.
Angle? What? Jesus flipping Christ.
He flushed and sputtered.
I'm real sorry, baby. I should have checked. But how the hell do you mess up a name like Angel?
At least they spelled the rest of it right.
Blind damn luck, I'm sure,
he said, then plopped down at the table.
All righty, Angle. How about you go ahead and cut us some pieces?
Laughing, I obliged, then took a big bite. My phone buzzed in my pocket as I was trying to get through a weirdly crunchy icing rose. I grabbed a napkin and spat the mess out. It's Alan, probably about my shift tomorrow. Alan Prejean was the chief investigator at the St. Edward's Parish Coroner's Office, and my boss. Though he knew the truth about my medical leave, the official but fake reason was mono. Funny how mononucleosis looked better on paperwork than dismembered and rotted. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Angel. Don't sound so happy to hear from me. It's unnatural.
It's the new me, I said cheerfully.
Well, cut it out, he grumbled.
Look, I know you weren't due to be back at work until tomorrow, but can you come in today? Jerry broke a tooth and has to go to the dentist, and we're a bit overwhelmed.
What time do you need me?
I hate to say it, but as soon as you can be here. I'm heading out to pick up a body even now. Sorry about the short notice, but...
No, it's okay. Hang on a sec. I covered the phone with my hand and looked over at my dad, but he was already nodding and giving me a go-on hand waggle. I can be there in about 45 minutes. It was a 20-minute drive to Tucker Point, plus I needed to find my work uniforms and hope like hell they hadn't been moldering in a pile of dirty laundry for the past 3 weeks.
Perfect. I owe you one. See ya in 45.
I disconnected. Sorry about that, Dad.
It's no biggie, baby, he said with a fond smile. I know I ain't the only one happy to see you up and about again.
You're the best. I kissed the top of his head. I don't suppose you did laundry while I was gone?
No,
he said to my dismay. But then his eyes twinkled.
Gina did, though.
I stopped.
Blinked.
Who the fuck is Gina?
Oh, God, not another trashy girlfriend. And yes, I was fully aware of the irony of me thinking that. But my dad's girlfriends took trashy to a whole new level.
He snickered at the look on my face.
You'll like her. Don't worry. Your uniforms are all hanging in your closet.
Hanging?
Hell, that was more than I ever did.
Still, I leveled a cool glare at him. Are you dating her? He stuffed a forkful of cake into his mouth and grinned around it. Rolling my eyes, I continued on to my bedroom, only now realizing that the house was clean, like spotless. A peek into the bathroom showed that the tub was sparkling and the yucky ring in the toilet had vanished. And my bed was made with fresh sheets. I could get to like Gina.
Chapter 2. Dressed in my ironed fatigue pants and uniform shirt, and with the scent of springtime fresh fabric softener wafting around me, I stepped through the back door of the coroner's office building 38 minutes after Alan's call. I drew a slow breath. Formalin and bleach, along with a hint of death no cleaning could ever erase. Then let it out in a happy sigh. An aroma as welcoming to me as fresh baked cookies. A deep and resonant baritone hum I easily recognized drifted from the cutting room. I stopped in the doorway and smiled in delight. Darrell Cusimano, protective gear stark white against his dark skin, deftly sewed up the Y incision on a mottled corpse. A former linebacker for LSU, he was the first death investigator I'd ever been partnered with, and one of the nicest people in the world.
Yo, I said.
Darrell lifted his head, and a huge smile spread across his face. He made a final stitch, then shucked gloves, apron, and smock, and stuffed them into a medical waste can.
One sick,
he said with a wink. Once he'd scrubbed and dried his hands, he swept me off my feet and into the hug to rule all hugs.
I missed you.
By nose,
I managed. Laughing, he released me. I made a show of making sure my nose hadn't been permanently flattened.
Missed you too, big guy. Are you my partner today?
No such luck. I'm done in 5 minutes. You'll be with Nick.
He snorted.
Maybe now that you're working again, he'll stop being old Nick.
You mean?
Nick the prick. Touchy as all hell.
He cocked a sly smile my way.
Guess he missed you too.
I kept my face composed despite the doubt that pulled at my stomach. Did Nick miss me? I sure as hell missed him. Or was he still freaked out that the girl he liked had turned out to be a brain-eating monster? One who'd rotted away before his very eyes. He had texted me only once, not long after I woke up. Alan said, "You'll be off work for a week. Darrell and I are covering half your shifts. You owe me. I have your masks. Hope you're feeling better." Painfully neutral, but less ominous than silence. I'd read that text at least 50 times, trying to find some nugget of reassurance that what I felt for him might still be reciprocated.
"Speak of the devil,"
Darrell murmured, as Nick entered the morgue. Darrell placed a hand on my shoulder and gave it an encouraging squeeze. Nick stopped dead.
"Angel,"
he said, voice weirdly hoarse. His Adam's apple bobbed.
"I thought you weren't scheduled until tomorrow."
Under any other circumstances, I'd have teased him with, "What, aren't you glad to see me?" But there was too much chance it might be true, and I couldn't handle knowing that right now. "Jerry broke a tooth," I said instead. "Alan asked me to cover." A strained smile tugged at his mouth, but didn't quite win over the uncertainty in his eyes.
"That's cool. I mean, not for Jerry, but, yeah. It's good to have you here."
He lurched forward as if prodded and gave me a stiff hug. A shudder passed through him and he pulled away. Revulsion or relief?
"You're okay now."
He gestured awkwardly toward me, then seemed to think better of it and dropped his hand to his side. Holy crap, this sucked.
"I need to go,"
Darrell said.
"Y'all play nice."
To my surprise, Darrell smashed me into a second hug and murmured into my ear,
"Whatever's going on between you two, it'll all work out."
I nodded against his chest, but a hard knot filled my throat. No way would he be so encouraging if he knew about the whole incognito zombie thing. He released me, grabbed his satchel, and headed out the back door, leaving me and Nick to stare at each other. 3 painful seconds later, the door reopened and Darrell poked his head in.
"Alan's back with a body, and Ben just pulled in."
"I'll go help them,"
Nick blurted and sprint walked out. The instant the door closed, I let myself have a super quick, whisper quiet, third grade level flouncing why me tantrum, complete with not third grade cursing. The tactic worked to improve my mood a teensy bit, enough that I was able to give Detective Ben Roth a genuine smile when he stepped in. It helped that he was my favorite detective. Over 6 feet tall and burly, he could be plenty intimidating when he needed to be, but he'd always been friendly and chill with me.
"Hey, Angel,"
he returned my smile.
"Weird. You don't look dead. Why'd you miss all that work if you weren't dead, slacker?"
"Har, har," I said with a grin, "if he only knew. You know perfectly well I work harder than anyone else here. And damn, dude, you're looking pretty good. Have you lost weight?" The spare tire around his waist had shrunk considerably.
30 pounds.
His smile widened.
"I want to look good for the wedding."
I let out a squeal.
"You're engaged?"
Ben lifted his left hand to show a slim gold band on the third finger.
"Sure am. Neil proposed to me this past weekend."
He wisely didn't resist as I seized his hand and did a proper scrutiny and, ooh, pretty, over the inset of 4 dark red gems.
"Total surprise," he continued. "He told me we were going to a movie, but instead took me to Romero's Steakhouse. I was clueless, even though the place was about as romantic as you can get. He had a table reserved by the water with candlelight and everything. Didn't click until he did the one knee thing.
he chuckled.
My detective skills must have taken a vacation.
I'm so happy for you, I gushed, relinquishing his hand. Y'all are going to be the most gorgeous couple ever.
Well, you can see for yourself, June 20th,
he said.
Invitation should be going out next week.
The back door opened before I could start happy weeping. Alan held it while Nick pushed in a gurney bearing a black body bag.
Take him straight to the cutting room, Alan told Nick. I'll get him logged in.
I snatched gloves and followed Nick. Together, we hefted the body bag from the gurney onto the metal autopsy table.
Douglas Horton,
Ben said, flipping open his notebook.
A hunter whose boat overturned sometime early yesterday. Search and rescue found the body this morning and are still looking for his buddy.
His expression soured.
Life jackets were in the boat. That lot of good they did there.
You don't think it was a murder? I asked. Maybe his buddy whacked him and took off. Ben's eyes crinkled.
I'm not ruling anything out yet. That said, the boat definitely hit a log and overturned. Plus, if his buddy did decide to murder him, he picked a lousy spot to do it. He wouldn't get far in the swamp without a boat of his own.
Maybe he had an accomplice, I offered. Someone who put the log in the way and waited nearby in a second boat, and then the murderer whacked Douglas and then jumped out of the boat before it hit the log. Okay, yeah, it's a stretch.
Yes, it is,
Ben said.
But I like the way you think.
Alan stepped in, clipboard in hand.
Dr. LeBlanc wants us to get our boy here opened up to save time. Nick, why don't you take care of the pics?
Gotcha.
Nick unzipped the bag, then retreated as an eye-watering stench of shit and rot flowed out. Within the bag lay the corpse of a pasty white, middle-aged man with skinny legs and an impressive beer gut. Part of a beer gut, at least. A sizable chunk was gone from the left side, exposing mangled bowels, the source of most of the stink. Ugly punctures covered his thighs, and the meat had been stripped off from his right arm, shoulder to elbow, the bone marred by deep scrapes.
Jesus,
he muttered, then moved off to retrieve the camera. Ben's phone buzzed. He glanced at the screen and grimaced.
Hate to leave the shit fest here, but an FBI agent I've been working with wants to meet up. Alan, if you could forward the report to me when it's done, I'd appreciate it.
Will do,
Alan replied. I stomped down the urge to ask if his meeting was with Special Agent Sorsha Aberdeen, and if it had anything to do with the roadblock this morning. Now wasn't the time or place. Ben departed, and I returned to my perusal of the corpse. Propeller didn't do that damage, I said with a frown. Those are bite marks. Alan leaned close.
Yup. Alligator, at least two of them.
He pointed to a distinct bite.
See, this one has a snaggle tooth in the front. The one beside it doesn't. My guess is Mr. Horton drowned after the boat flipped and was then feasted upon.
How'd you know a gator didn't drown him? I asked with a frown. Isn't that how they kill their prey? He twitched a shoulder up in a shrug.
Gators aren't usually aggressive enough to go after a full-grown man.
Maybe the gator had a buddy who told him he was big and bad enough to take down a pot-bellied hunter too cocky to wear a life jacket. Alan rolled his eyes.
Fine. There's a dastardly duo of man-eating gators lurking in the swamps of St. Edward's Parish.
He waggled his fingers at me.
Go get your gear on. Some of us have shit to do.
I stuck my tongue out at him, but headed to the prep room with a spring in my step, humming under my breath as I grabbed a gown and apron from the supply cabinet. I felt like I was back home. Made sense considering it was my home in a lot of ways. I had held this job for over a year and a half,
ever since Marcus Ivanov saved me from dying by turning me into a zombie. He'd arranged for this job and informed me, anonymously, that I had to take it or I'd go to prison, where I would die. Dramatic, but it worked. I'd hauled my head out of my ass, got my shit together enough to keep the job, and along the way, discovered I was a zombie, and liked, needed, to eat brains. But the job turned out to be more than a buffet. This was where I'd learned how to be a grown-up, responsible, even. I'd made friends, real friends, who didn't hang out with me only to score pills or pot. A shout of alarm from the cutting room jerked me out of my reverie. Nick. I dashed in, then stumbled to a stop as my brain struggled to process the scene. The body of Douglas Horton was on the floor. He fell off the table, I thought, then stared in horror as Douglas staggered to his feet, right arm dangling uselessly and small intestines trailing. But he's dead. Douglas lurched toward Nick. No! I ran full out and tackled Douglas as hard as my skinny little ass could manage. The guy wasn't exactly a lightweight, but I had enough momentum to send us both crashing into a steel storage cabinet. Douglas gave a wet, warbling moan that raised the hairs at the nape of my neck, then clamped his good hand onto my upper arm. I yelped in surprise, even more surprised when my body remembered a fragment of jujitsu and twisted against the grip to free myself. Angel, move! I stumbled aside just in time as Alan and Nick jammed the rolling table against Douglas to pin him against the cabinet. The dead man let out another eerie wail, shoved at the table, then swiped his arm out. Nick jerked his head back, then managed to merely get clipped on the jaw instead of walloped. He hissed a curse, but held his ground beside Alan. But it was clear they wouldn't be able to keep Douglas pinned much longer. Heads up! I snatched the fire extinguisher from the wall, then swung it at Dougie's skull as hard as I could. Except he was over a foot taller than me, and with the table in the way, I only managed to graze his shoulder and smash the extinguisher into the cabinet, leaving an impressive dent. To add insult to injury, the rebound ripped the fire extinguisher from my hands and sent it sailing across the room. However, my masterful shoulder graze had riled Douglas up. He let out a sputtering roar and overturned the table, knocking Alan and Nick off balance, then took a lumbering step in my direction, hand reaching toward me like a claw. I was cornered, and I wasn't brained up enough to have super zombie powers. Sure, I could take a lot of damage, but damn it, I'd just recovered from being in pieces. No way was I going through that again. I ducked a swipe, then lunged at the tray of autopsy tools. My hand closed on a pair of scissors right before he smacked the tray and sent the contents flying. Thunk. Douglas staggered. Behind him, Alan stood with the fire extinguisher, poised to deliver another blow. Douglas pivoted with a wet growl and flung his arm up. Alan danced away, barely in time. The back of Douglas's head had a dent like the cabinet's, but clearly it wasn't enough to slow him down. Like Judd. My mouth went dry. Judd Seiler had turned into something horribly similar to this. And that was after I'd removed most of his brain for a desperately needed snack. But I'd left behind the medulla and most of the cerebellum, the parts that made everything work. And then I'd defeated him by destroying those essential bits. With a fierce shriek, I leaped onto Douglas's back, wrapped an arm around his neck and my legs around his waist. Fist tight on the scissors, I wedged the point into the base of the dent in his skull, jammed them in and down, hard. Douglas howled and arched his back, but I shoved the scissors deeper and sawed them in messy circles as if mixing a really thick milkshake. Douglas went slack, then crumbled, face down. Breathing hard, I released my death grip on him and clambered to my feet. Nick stood a couple of yards away, shoulders heaving and fire axe in hand. Still brandishing the canister, Alan eyed the prone man warily.
Is he neutralized?
God, I hope so, I said. But he will be for sure once we get the brain out. All of it. I clenched and unclenched my hands, fighting the worry that threatened to swallow me. Where was this guy found? Which swamp?
Upper Mudsucker Swamp,
Alan replied.
Northeast end, near Pouvre Bayou.
Questions crowded his eyes, but Nick spoke before he could voice them.
What the hell do we do with him now?
All three of us looked down at the caved-in skull with the scissors sticking out of the dent. We couldn't simply get rid of the body, not when he was supposed to be autopsied, then sent to the funeral home. Maybe Dr. LeBlanc will believe the damage happened in the swamp? I offered weakly. Post-mortem injuries? Nick sucked in a sharp breath.
Dr. LeBlanc, he's due back from court any minute now.
Alan cursed and yanked the scissors free.
Do the picks, fast. We'll get him opened up. Angel, you need to get that brain out. ASAP.
Together, we wrestled Douglas onto the table. Nick grabbed the camera and took pictures as fast as humanly possible. The instant he finished, Alan started the Y incision on the chest while I sliced through the scalp and peeled it away from the skull. Nick stowed the camera, then hurried to get the room cleaned up so it wasn't quite so obvious we'd battled a zombie. Definitely a zombie. Except it wasn't my kind of zombie. A shambler like Judd, I thought with a shiver, and added, panic about the implications at the top of my to-do list. I took the bone saw to the skull, forcing myself to focus on the task at hand and not look at the clock, or at Nick as he frantically cleaned up blood, shit, and scattered instruments. Samples, I breathed. Alan, I need samples for Dr. Nikas. Dr. Ariston Nikas was the tribe's research scientist and the go-to person for all things weird. The ideal scenario would be to deliver the entire body to him so that he could use the resources in the zombie research lab to figure out what the hell had caused Douglas to shamble. But the family no doubt wanted to do the whole funeral thing and would probably notice the lack of a body, so tissue and blood samples would have to do. Alan gave a curt nod.
Understood.
A distant sound of a door cut through the air.
Hallway,
I croaked. We had less than a minute, even if Dr. LeBlanc took his sweet time down the long corridor from the front of the building. I pulled the top of the skull off and tossed it onto the table, then slipped a scalpel between brain and skull to slice through the brainstem. As I tipped the brain out into my hands, my gut dropped at the sight of the mangled cerebellum and medulla. No way would Dr. LeBlanc believe a blow to the head had caused that damage. Alan glanced at the brain as footsteps approached.
We're fucked, he muttered.
Behind me, the door opened.
Good afternoon, Dr. LeBlanc said.
Go big or go home, Angel. Faking a startle, I fumbled the brain and deliberately let it slip through my grasp to splat on the floor. Like a balloon full of jello.
I whirled, wearing the best horrified expression I could pull off.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry, Dr. LeBlanc.
A grimace flitted across his face, but in the next instant, it was replaced by his usual kind smile.
It's all right, Angel. It's not as if the cause of death is a mystery.
Before I knew it, he'd crossed to me and pulled me into his arms to give me an utterly lovely and heart-melting squeeze, clearly not caring about my gore-covered gloves.
Welcome back. You have no idea how happy I am to see you doing so well.
Guilt tugged at me, but I mentally kicked it aside and let myself wallow in the wonderful embrace, as much as I could while holding my yucky hands away from him. Dr. LeBlanc's hug was as comforting as a warm, cozy blanket on a cold day. I gave him a smile as he released me. Yep, I'm all better.
To my eternal delight, he said. Mono can be tough to recover from. Kudos for being young and healthy.
Excuse me, Angel, Alan said.
He scooped up the mangled brain into a plastic tub, then tilted his head toward the body.
He's all ready for you, Doc.
He set the tub on the counter beside me, then stepped to the autopsy table with Dr. LeBlanc. Nick casually slipped an empty plastic baggie into my hand before joining the others. I glanced over to confirm he and Alan were holding Dr. LeBlanc's attention. Within seconds, I had four small chunks of brain in the baggie, and the baggie in the pocket of my cargo pants. With any luck at all, that would be enough for Dr. Nikas. Because if my suspicions were correct, we were going to need all the luck in the world. Chapter 3. While Dr. LeBlanc remained occupied, I mumbled an excuse about needing to potty, then shed my yucky gloves and slipped out. The brain sample bag squished and shifted in my pocket as I walked. Yuck. I'd been carrying human brains around for over a year and a half, but this was the first time I was even a teensy bit grossed out. I ducked into the restroom, locked the door, then texted Dr. Nikas. Corpse in the morgue woke up on the cutting table. Just like Judd, hunter drowned in Mudsucker Swamp, bit by gators. I disordered his medal. Scowling, I fixed my phone's damn autocorrect. Scissored his medulla, so no threat now. Have samples of brain, but Dr. L doing autopsy now. Dr. L didn't see, only Alan and Nick. I hit send and waited anxiously. The reply came less than a dozen seconds later. That's very disturbing. Despite everything, I had to smile at his unflappable manner. What should I do? I waited nearly a minute, then. Rachel is in your area. Can she pick up the samples?
Blech.
Rachel was one of the top security people for our zombie tribe. I didn't care for her, and she couldn't stand the sight of me.
I have to go back in for autopsy, which was true.
We'll leave the baggie on right front tire of my car. That way I wouldn't have to actually deal with her. Excellent. If at all possible, I would appreciate it if you could obtain other samples from the decedent. Bring them when you come here after your shift. He proceeded to list what he needed. Tissue samples from every organ imaginable, scrapings from beneath the fingernails, and samples of blood, vitreous, bile, cervical spinal fluid, urine, saliva, and even fecal matter. Ew. I'll do what I can. Of course, I'll see you this afternoon. I flushed the toilet, in case anyone was listening, then hurried to the parking lot to place the baggie on the tire. Alan glanced up as I returned to the cutting room, then continued with his removal of the liver. At the counter, Dr. LeBlanc sectioned a lung. Nick placed a kidney in the scale and recorded the weight on the whiteboard. My eyes went to a red mark on Nick's jaw, where Douglas had clipped him. Damn it, that was going to bruise. Tugging on fresh gloves, I moved to the other side of the table from Alan and held skin and fat out of the way while he worked. The normal chatter was gone, held at bay by what we wanted to talk about but couldn't until Dr. LeBlanc left. Fortunately, the pathologist seemed to be too absorbed in his work to notice we were uncharacteristically quiet.
Cause of death appears to be drowning,
Dr. LeBlanc murmured, setting aside the lung and moving on to the heart. The crushing silence descended again. I cleared my throat.
So, what you all been up to lately?
Nick is in a play,
Dr. LeBlanc said as he made tiny slices in a vein.
No shit?
I swung my attention to Nick. He loved theater, but had given it up years ago to meet his dad's strict academic expectations.
Is that the Less Miserable thing you said you were going to audition for?
His mouth twitched.
Les Miserables. I got the part of Marius Pontmercy,
At my blank look, he rolled his eyes. Marius is one of the main characters.
That's awesome, I paused.
So, what did Bear say about it? Bear was his dad and hadn't always been a fan of Nick's love of theater. One shoulder jerked up in a shrug.
He said he'd come see me. The show opens next month.
I'll be there.
He looked away and placed the liver in the scale.
How's school going? Did you miss a lot of classes?
It's going pretty good, I said, only lying a little. My first semester of college was trying really hard to kick my ass. I started back last week. My doctor said I was okay to attend classes as long as I took it easy. Actually, Dr. Nikas had said since my mind hadn't suffered and I'd recovered enough strength to sit without exhaustion, there was no reason not to return to school. If I let my zombie baby Philip handle the driving and cart me around in a wheelchair. Plus, it was Mardi Gras break when I got sick, I added. So I ended up only missing 1 week of school. Nick jotted the weight of the liver on the whiteboard.
You keeping up in English?
Yeah. I lied a lot. Holding on to a C. And by C, I meant the lowest C- possible. I was seriously considering dropping the class, but I didn't want to tell Nick and risk him feeling obligated to tutor me again. Or awkward for not offering. Not to mention, I wasn't sure how well I'd handle us being alone together. Biology is fun, even though the professor is a real tool. We have quizzes every damn day, and I think he stays up nights to think of the hardest questions. He's also not even remotely nice. But he knows his shit, and it's super interesting. We just finished learning about bacteria, I grinned. Found out poop is mostly water and dead bacteria. Our bodies are teeming with bacteria, and for the most part, that's a good thing. I cocked my head, which I guess means we're covered with the corpses of bacteria, too. Yuck. Nick placed the liver on the counter.
They break down and get et by other bacteria. The problem comes during stuff like surgery. You can sterilize a scalpel, but the dead bacteria are still there. The body's immune system works by identifying certain chemical triggers in bacteria, and the corpses, including the toxins they release when dying, trigger the same response as living bacteria. That's why the dead bacteria are called pyrogens, Dr. LeBlanc said without looking up.
Wait, I know this, I said. Pyro means fire or heat, so a pyrogen is something that causes a fever? He flicked an approving glance my way.
Yes, they cause fevers, among other issues. Even death sometimes. That's why heart surgery scalpels go through a process called depyrogenation, which removes all the dead bits.
I shuddered. That's nasty. Alan snorted.
You're elbow deep in a body, and you say that's nasty?
At least I can see this nastiness. Dr. LeBlanc set the heart aside and lifted the somewhat smushed brain from the tub to the counter. I watched, barely daring to breathe as he frowned and peered more closely. At least his focus was on the frontal lobe and not the medulla, so far.
Alan, will you get a spinal fluid sample as well?
Dr. LeBlanc gently prodded the brain.
Will do, Alan replied.
He gave me a speaking glance, then added to Dr. LeBlanc.
Do you see something? I won't be certain until I can look at the samples under a microscope,
Dr. LeBlanc said.
But I believe there's inflammation. I maintain drowning was the cause of death, but he might have been suffering from some sort of encephalitis when he died. Or after he died, I thought grimly.
Alan retrieved a sample of cervical spinal fluid, squirted it into a vial and sealed it,
then placed it with the rest of the samples. The fluid was cloudy, which even I knew wasn't normal. While Dr. LeBlanc finished, Nick and Alan did cleanup, dawdling over every task. Meanwhile, I took my sweet time sewing up the body using big looping stitches, since I was gonna have to pull them all out anyway to get the samples Dr. Nikas wanted. After what felt like an eternity, Dr. LeBlanc shed his gloves, gathered up his notes, and left the cutting room. Unfortunately, we could still hear him moving around by the computers. I retrieved a cold pack from the first aid kit, cracked it, then thrust it at Nick. "Put this on your face." He let out a quiet scoff, but obeyed. Alan lifted an eyebrow.
"What? No ice for me? Maybe I got a boo-boo, too."
I smiled sweetly. "You already have the chill of your ice-cold heart." Nick smothered a laugh. Alan heaved a long-suffering sigh. A chair scraped in the other room, and we froze. Finally, footsteps retreated down the hall, and the door at the end creaked open and banged shut. Immediately, Alan pivoted to face me.
"Okay, what in the actual fuck was that?"
He flung an arm out toward the body.
"I've never seen a zombie act that way. Was he just really brain hungry?"
I frowned at the corpse. "I'm not sure what his deal is, but he definitely wasn't brain hungry, considering he came after me. My kind of zombie goes after real human brains. The times I've been really crazy hungry, I could smell a human a block away." Alan's brow furrowed.
"You can't eat a zombie's brain?"
"I suppose I could, but it's about as appealing as eating a human brain was before I got zombified." I shrugged. "A lack of brain scent is one way to tell if someone's a zombie." I stopped. "Hang on." I yanked the top off the tub with the mangled brain and took a deep whiff.
"Huh. Enlighten us?"
"It has a brain scent, but it's kind of not quite right. Like how lunch meat smells a bit off a day after its expiration date." "Yet Judd's brain hadn't smelled or tasted odd when I ate it. Then again, I'd smashed his skull open less than a minute after he died, still warm and fresh." Nick swallowed.
"Do you, have a desire to eat that?"
"No, not in the slightest." I replaced the lid, unsettled and not sure why. The smell of the brain wasn't repulsive, but the idea of eating it was. "It's definitely not a normal human brain, or a normal zombie brain. Hell, he's not a normal zombie, period. I mean, my kind doesn't mindlessly shamble like that dude."
"But Judd did." I held back a shudder. "Why did you want to know where the hunter was found?"
Alan asked, watching me closely.
"Do you have a theory about why this guy shambled?"
I hesitated, torn about how much to share. "Screw it. They needed to know. They were allies, right?"
"More like a hypothesis.
Y'all remember Judd Seiler?"
"His face was all over the news right after Mardi Gras," Nick said. "Wanted for murder and kidnapping. Big manhunt, but he's still at large."
"Well, they ain't gonna find him," I said, "'cause he's dead. Twice. He tried to kill me out by Lock 3, and I bit him, just a regular old bite on his arm. The next day, west of Mudsucker Swamp, he attacked me and ended up getting shot dead. Not by me," I hurried to add. I needed the fuel, so I busted his skull and ate his cerebrum. But later that night, he came after me as a shambler, even though he was missing the top of his head. I had to rip out his cerebellum and medulla to kill him for real."
Nick's throat worked. "That's how you knew to attack the medulla."
"It made the most sense." I grimaced and rubbed the back of my neck. "Thing is, I left Judd's body deep in the swamp. So if an alligator or three snacked on him, I don't know. Maybe they turned zombie too, and a couple of them chomped our guy here. Alan stared at me.
That's ludicrous.
I threw up my hands. The whole thing is insane. But what if there are zombie gators out there in the swamp? What if there are more shambly zombies out there? Here I am, trying to work out how my zombies can safely come out of hiding and go public. But if a whole bunch of shamblers start showing up, that's going to fuck over the real zombies. Alan and Nick exchanged an oddly significant glance. My eyes narrowed in a glare. What?
Alan and my dad and I have been talking about this going public stuff, Nick said. We agreed that you can't let the world know zombies are real, even if there wasn't a shambler complication.
I folded my arms over my chest. We are not going to stay in hiding forever.
Not forever. You just can't reveal yourselves anytime soon. There are serious drawbacks to coming out.
I know. We'll have all sorts of people deciding to become zombie hunters and...
No, Nick interrupted. I mean, yes. You'll have amateur zombie hunters, maybe even military. But more importantly, your legitimate brain sources will dry up.
I know, I said, then smiled. And I was about to say that. Trust me, I had a lot of downtime to think about it. It's not like we need blood where people can donate some and still live. To donate a brain to my dinner, that person pretty much has to be dead. And since no one wants to worry that Uncle Tommy might get eaten, the instant the news hits that brain eaters are real, every morgue and funeral home will start keeping an eagle eye on each brain that comes through their door. Nick's forehead puckered.
Exactly. So, how can you still be thinking of going public?
Because of you guys. And Marcus. Alan and Nick took on identical looks of confusion.
What did we do?
Alan asked cautiously. You're human, I said, and you don't think all zombies are monsters that need to be destroyed. Human allies will make a huge difference. Like how Nick and his dad helped me keep zombies from being exposed. And how you skimmed brains for me and told Dr. Nikas about the ghoul grease salve. Alan had stumbled upon a secret world of zombies during a medical aid rotation in the Central African Republic. His disclosure of the components for a zombie-only wound salve had triggered new developments in Dr. Nikas's research. We still need to figure out more ways to reduce our need for real brains, but it's a humongous start.
All right, Alan said. And what did Marcus do?
He inherited a chain of funeral homes, I said. Okay, so they were already zombie-owned, but my point is we can safeguard some of those brain sources. Maybe get more allies in the morgues. I wrinkled my nose. But it'll take time, and we need to safeguard those sources before the general public gets freaked out by a shambling zombie horde.
Let's deal with the problems we know of, Alan said. What samples does Dr. Nikas need? Better get them now while we can.
I'll text you that. I stopped as Alan's phone buzzed. He heaved a sigh as he read the message.
Crappy timing. Body up in Bidu. Possible heart attack. Texting the address to you both now. Don't worry, Angel. I'll take care of getting the samples.
I thanked him fervently and forwarded the list to him. It would take a lot longer for Alan to do it on his own, but he didn't seem at all put out. Because he knows how important this is, I realized as I followed Nick out to the parking lot. Alan was an ally. Maybe even a friend? Nick peeled off toward the Durango, and I climbed into the van, snickering to myself. Never thought I'd see the day I was friendly with Alan Prejean, much less consider him a possible friend. What next? A reign of puppies? Dr. Angel Crawford? With a snort for the ridiculous mental images, I plugged the address into my GPS and left to get a corpse. Chapter 4. Once upon a time, when I first started working at the coroner's office, I'd thought it a waste of gas and money to have the death investigator and the body snatcher, me, in two separate vehicles. After all, why couldn't we both ride in the van? It didn't take me long to realize the death investigator did more than simply help babysit the body. They often had to stay at the scene to speak to next of kin and hunt down paperwork and medical records long after I headed back to the morgue. Not to mention, it was the investigator's duty to give death notifications to the decedent's loved ones, something I had absolutely zero desire to ever do. I knew damn well I'd break down crying right then and there. And I was never more grateful for separate vehicles than right now. Bideau was at the very north end of the parish, a 25-minute drive with no traffic. If Nick and I had been trapped together in the van, it would have been 25 minutes of torturous silence broken by occasional stilted conversation, and then 25 minutes back with a corpse who was unlikely to be talkative. I'd only been to Bideau a couple of times, and I murmured a prayer that the GPS would be up to the task of getting me there again. On a map, it looked easy. Highway, then another highway, then another highway, then yet one more highway. But in reality, each highway was smaller and less traveled than the last, with wickedly easy-to-miss turnoffs. Yet it wasn't the GPS that helped me find the first turn. It was the brand-spanking-new billboard at the junction with Saberton, splashed across the top in enormous letters. I pulled to the shoulder and glared up at the sign. Opening soon, Saberton Agricultural Equipment Manufacturing. Now hiring all positions. Turn left here, then head south on Old Haybarn Road. Interesting. And odd. A couple of years ago, Saberton Corporation bought the tractor factory that had been up and running for near 50 years. And they'd immediately laid off all the employees. They'd promised to hire everyone back once they nailed a juicy defense contract and started production on some sort of new tank. But the defense contract had fallen through, and therefore so had the jobs. Now it seemed they'd decided to return to making tractors. Though it wasn't a complete surprise, I wasn't quite sure how to feel about this turn of events. Saberton had a nasty bent for unethical research on zombies, and no good would come of them having a stronger toehold in the zombie tribe area. Yet I couldn't help but be relieved for all the people who'd get their jobs back. Naomi might know more about how this crap came about, especially since she was the daughter of Saberton's CEO. I made a mental note to ask her when I next saw her, most likely later today, since she worked for the tribe, and I'd be taking the Douglas Horton samples to the lab as soon as my shift was over. I snapped a quick phone pic of the billboard, then pulled back onto the highway. At the scene, Nick's Durango and a sheriff's office vehicle were parked on the street in front of a snug house with missing shingles and a tidy yard. I joined Nick inside where Mr. Carlton Prince lay in his bed. 67 years old, skinny as a rail, no muscle tone, a history of heart disease, and a pack-a-day smoking habit. Dr. LeBlanc might not even autopsy him, especially considering the dead man's skin was flushed red from mid-chest up, a strong indication of a heart attack. Most likely, the doc would simply check for signs of suspicious wounds and run a tox screen to make sure Mr. Prince hadn't been hurried off to the afterlife with a little physical or chemical help. I laid out the body bag while Nick interviewed a middle-aged woman with generous curves and kind eyes, the neighbor who'd found the body. She'd spoken with Mr. Prince the previous evening and agreed to give him a ride to his doctor's office today. After he didn't answer the doorbell, she let herself in and found him still in bed and clearly deceased.
"Went to sleep and never woke up," Nick murmured after she left. "Not a bad way to go, I'd say."
"Only if you know it might be coming," I said. He gave me a quizzical look, and I added, What scares me most about dying is dying unexpectedly. I want to be able to say goodbye to people, tie up all the loose ends, that sort of thing. His eyes met mine briefly before his gaze darted away.
Yeah,
he said, voice oddly rough. He'd seen me come close to dying a few weeks ago.
Here, I'll help you.
Together, we got Carlton Prince into the body bag, though the guy was so light I could have managed it easily on my own, even without any sort of zombie-aided strength. A shiver of unease trailed up my spine as I wheeled the gurney out of the house. My dad had a similar scrawny and unexercised build. An image of a body bag zipper closing over my dad's lifeless face burned itself into my brain. Blinking hard, I continued to the van, oddly grateful the uneven sidewalk meant I had to concentrate on keeping the gurney upright, with no mental space free to worry about my dad dying. Yet once I got the gurney loaded up and started toward the morgue, the unsettling image returned full force. I swiped at my eyes and turned the music way up and sang along, making up my own lyrics when I didn't know the real ones. By the time I passed the Saberton billboard, I'd shaken the worst of the morbid thoughts, and my spirits had recovered somewhat. It was silly for me to compare the body in the back of the van to my dad. Carlton Prince was 15 years older than Jimmy Crawford, and my dad didn't have heart disease. Not that I knew of, at least. Ugh. I didn't even know when he'd last seen a doctor. Somehow I needed to convince him to get a physical and quit smoking for good. I sighed. Or maybe I could reverse climate change. That would be easier. My half shift was all but over by the time I made it to the morgue with Mr. Prince. Alan helped me get him entered into the system and tucked away in the cooler, then let me know